Welcome to the Smarter, Wealthier Podcast, presented by Jags Mechanical, with your host, Spencer Dillinger, and co-host, Gabe Rogers. And here they are.
All right. So today we are talking about why you're still broke, even with a good paycheck.
They don't make a wrench to fix me, that's why I'm always broke.
You're making good money, you know, so why doesn't it feel like you're getting ahead? Today we're going to be talking about the real reason your bank account isn't growing. It's not your spending habits.
Or is it? Late night right. Amazon shopping.
That's the real reason. Everybody, we can save you millions. Just delete your Amazon app from your wife's phone.
From your wife's phone. I literally just got like three emails that were just returns to Amazon. My wife's literally returning Amazon packages right now.
Yeah, my wife doesn't buy a ton of stuff from Amazon, but she does return a lot of stuff to Amazon.
So she's cheating the system. She's stealing it off the shelves of Walmart and returning it to Amazon.
Oh, my goodness. All right. So some stats to kick us off here with what we're talking about today. 78% of American workers live paycheck to paycheck, including one in four households earning over $100,000 a year. This is from CNBC Lending Club 2024. The median net worth of a renter is $6,700. That's probably their car.
That's their median income?
That's their net worth. Median net worth.
I got you.
Median net worth of a homeowner is $396,200. That source is from the Federal Reserve and Survey of Consumer Finances 2022. Only 20% of millionaires inherited any wealth. The other 80% built it by acquiring income-producing assets. That comes from Ramsey Solutions National Study of Millionaires. And lastly, $7,000 a month income with no assets creates zero generational wealth, but owning just two duplexes with four units total, $1,200 rent each, equals $4,800 a month in passive income forever. Which, you know, that word passive there is highly questionable, but
that's a really subjective thing there.
Yeah, for sure.
You know that just in what you do.
Yeah, so the direction we're going to go with this, and if you can't already tell, we're going to be talking about one really big key to actually achieving, you know, financial freedom, wealth, whatever your definition of success looks like. You're probably feeling like you're treading water a lot. I know we've all been there. We've all been in that situation. But there is one really big thing that makes a difference. And I'm going to let Gabe share with you what he thinks first is the number one thing that makes a difference in creating wealth.
The number one thing that comes to mind in when we were just talking a few minutes before we started was a lot of times, and every person I've talked to is, if I make $10 and I spend $11, that's a bad thing. We all know that, but it happens on such a grander scale that I've noticed a lot of people miss that, where living inside of your means is the first thing that popped in my mind. I remember there was a day where we brought home, I think my weekly paycheck, I brought home $236 a week. And granted, I had to live paycheck to paycheck by that point. That was a family of two, me and my wife, and $236 as an income is pretty low to make all of our bills and all of our payments. But one of the things that it taught us is to be disciplined in the things that we wanted to do. We had to live within our means. I couldn't spend $237 a week. I had to spend $236 exactly, or else there would be a problem. So living within your means is the first thing that always comes to mind when we come to the point of you just spend, like I said, $10, you can't spend $11. You have to spend less than $10 if you want anything left over and have the ability to build wealth at that point. Sure. And this question's not anywhere on any of our stuff, but wealth, I think, is a term that gets thrown around as if you're wealthy or rich. And I think that is incorrect. And maybe you can expound a little bit on what wealth means to you.
So, yeah, I've always heard, people delineate between rich and wealthy. You can make $200,000 a year and have no wealth. You can make $500,000 a year and have no wealth, but you're rich. But somebody who's wealthy is going to win the game of Monopoly. You know what I'm saying? They own more of the squares on the board. Wealth is the owning of assets, in my opinion. And it really doesn't matter the asset. It just matters that you're focused more on net worth and less on annual income. Because exactly what you mentioned, when we make more, we tend to spend more. And everything that I talk about as far as creating wealth today, it does not work if you continue to increase your lifestyle as fast as you increase your income.
That's true. Well, I mean, that kind of brings me to the question that I did want to ask you is, and we even talked a little bit about it at the beginning of this with your statistics, isn't a high paycheck enough to build a good life? Why isn't that working for most people?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the thing about it is, a great paycheck could make a great life, for sure. It does matter what you do with it. We have the ability to spend an unlimited amount of money. You know, it's really something that people always are like, well, if I made this much money, I'd never spend all that. I would just, I would have leftover because I wouldn't be able to do all that. But if you meet people that do make that amount of money, they're always interested in making more. And most of the time they'll tell you, I have this and this. And especially with monthly subscriptions, you can join clubs and groups that cost tens of thousands of dollars a month to be a part of. And it all seems like, oh, I can afford this. I make good money. So I really think, to answer your question, I think the reason that making a good paycheck isn't enough to make a good life is strictly down to what you do with it. Most people, I think, the first year that they make good money, they're like, oh my gosh, I have so much money. And then the second year they make the same amount, they're like, man, I'm living paycheck to paycheck. Because they're spending more. And your habits change and your expenses change.
I heard a preacher say this at a church conference maybe a couple months ago, and he was talking about, I don't even remember what billionaire, he was reading a quote from him, and someone was interviewing him, and he said, how much is enough? And the billionaire is like, just a little bit more. Just a little bit more.
Yeah.
And it's funny because we can spend
an unlimited amount of money. It's not a finite number.
So,
yeah. So, I was going to say before we get too far into this that I think the real secret between people who create lasting wealth and financial freedom and people who don't is the acquisition of assets. That's what I believe. I mean, you definitely have to do what you talked about in the beginning here of living below your means to acquire the asset in the first place. But if you're not acquiring assets, people always say, well, cash is king. I'm like, yeah, it is when you have a bill that you don't have the cash for. But cash is one of the worst performing assets of all time because over, the last century, it's lost a tremendous amount of value, and that trend is probably going to continue.
And the word inflation starts getting thrown around.
For sure. So I think that if you were to offer me to give me a $15,000 asset or to give me $15,000, I would choose the asset.
Because it's going to grow at a greater rate.
Yeah, I mean, depending on what it is, if it's going to cost me more money, like a boat or something to own, then maybe not.
Bust out another thousand. That's what boat stands for, right?
Yeah. Yep. So the thing that I think will make the biggest difference for the average person is their personal house, right? That's the thing that most people think of when you talk about asset. So I'm going to go ahead and ask you, based on what I'm saying about assets, what is an asset that you have bought, if any, that changed the way you thought about money?
Well, I remember, we'll just go back to the first like thing that I realized was an asset that I bought, which would have been my first house. Before that, I didn't even know what the word asset meant. And first of all, I just bought something. I remember me and my wife were looking at it. We had one child at the time, and the other one was on the way. When we looked at a house, and I think we paid like $105,000 for our first house. 2014. And I remember thinking, man, this is so much money. I mean, this is like just throwing money away. And then a couple years later, I remember just having a conversation with a banker, and they were like, you do realize your house is worth $150,000 and you paid $100,000, and now you just gained 50% of your money back. I mean, obviously, if you go through like the whole breakdown of what you pay in property taxes, make sure everyone votes for Vivek to get rid of property taxes. Just throw that in there. But there's a whole thing of like, I finally was like, wait a second. So I paid $100,000 and now it's worth $150,000. So I gained 50% of cash. And he was like, yeah, if you sell your house for that, you will 100% get your money out of it. Or you could do like all these other, you know, I call it financial gymnastics to get the money out now and things like that. And so I began to inquire in that. And that's the first time I realized, like, holy cow, if you have an asset, there is a lot more, like, you have more financial ability. I don't want to say freedom, but ability to do things. And that was the first time I ever realized that how an asset works and why people want to own physical things that appreciate instead of depreciate. And it changed my mind of saying, okay, now when I'm spending X amount of dollars, I want it to appreciate or at least stay the same at minimum. I can't have this just be like, this is an experience that I'm spending it on. Now, granted, I'm not against vacations or experience or anything like that, but there is, like, you do have to live life. I'm 100% go enjoy life. YOLO. You only live once, right? That's a real thing. Go enjoy your life. But having the ability to have something that's constantly building on to where in the future my children can either be a part of that asset or it's passed on and I'm not passing on debt to them, but I'm passing on something that's worth something to them. Sure. Or, hey, I can take it out in a pinch or something's going on and I can sell these assets and retire or whatever that may look like. So,
absolutely. I think when I first bought my first house, I didn't understand, you know, assets and liabilities at all. And I thought of it in terms of, I'm going to have this much debt. And all I could think about was like, how do I pay off this debt? And I was like, how do I pay it off in 10 years? And I'm not against paying off debt completely. But I do think if I had known the future, I wouldn't have been so worried about it. If I had known what that would look like. Because I think for most people, their house becomes a forced savings account. Yeah. Because a little bit of your monthly payment every month is going towards the principal of the loan. Hopefully your house is worth more than the loan. So you're setting aside $200 every month, maybe $200 to $500, depending on what your
house payment
Your house payment is, your interest rate, and all that, which is more than most people ever commit to saving or even putting in a 401k. But I do want to talk a little bit about how and we might not be experts in this, but how do you get an asset today? You know, how do you purchase your first house or make your first investment? Yeah, I have a couple ideas, but I'm going to let you share some things first.
Well, it's kind of funny because I'm like a big proponent, and you know this. I mean, we just left lunch and I had a conversation with you today about just properties. I'm always a fan of, obviously, as a religious person, definitely take some time to think and pray about some things before you purchase anything. But also, number two, I also like to find some counsel a little bit of people who are doing things that are in the realm of what I want to do with those assets. Hey, I'm interested in buying classic cars. Well, I'm not going to go talk to Spencer, who's interested in buying property, about buying classic cars. I'm going to find a handful of people who are doing well at that and say, hey, can I take you to lunch? I want to ask you some questions about this. This is something I'm interested in doing.
That is a hugely overlooked thing that I don't think a lot of people think about, is like, if you are willing to take somebody to lunch that is the subject matter expert, you can almost always get them to go to lunch with you.
And get the information.
A significant amount.
And it's cheap. Lunch might cost you $50.
Cheap education, yeah. I mean, it really might cost you $100. I mean, yeah. Depending on where you go.
Take them to dinner. Take their wife and family to dinner. I mean, even if you have to spend $150, that's cheaper than spending $100,000 on an asset that fails and it costs you $50,000. So, but I'm always a big fan of looking into that. I think a lot of people are matter expert, and we're even talking about it today, and we both said we're definitely not matter experts on this for sure.
Well, I only said that because we are not starting out today, you know, and I think today, with post-COVID inflation and all of the things that have happened over the last 5 years, it's very difficult to start out today.
Yeah.
You need a lot more capital.
Well, I was getting to the point of people going, taking someone to lunch is a lot better than the way people are mostly handling it, which is, let's get on YouTube and see what guy's successful at it, and we're just going to do the thing that the guy on YouTube does.
And the guy on YouTube started 10 years ago when the climate was completely different.
Yeah. And he's been working at it probably 40 hours a day.
No, he's an overnight success.
Yeah. So that's the thing that, like, I always say, I forget which scripture it is in the Bible, but in the counsel of many, there's safety. So having it ran by two or three people, let me run this by you, that are matter experts or in that field. And hey, let me run you by what my idea, what my thought is, and what my purpose of doing this is, and getting some input on that. I think by doing that, you end up getting, you make better decisions. It's kind of funny. Me and my wife were talking last night that every time I've ever been in a bind, air quote, or have had to fix a situation, it's because I just wanted to do it on my own and was like, I'm just going to do this. And I didn't really put much thought into it. So I'm also of the mindset, and I think most of the people that we run around with are like, we're going to make it work.
Yep.
Even if we have to take this big piece of steel, this square steel, and we have to jam it through this circle steel hole, we will melt it, weld it, beat it, get it hot, whatever it takes to get it into fit. We're like, we're going to figure out how to get this fit, because we made up our mind that this is where this goes. And so, like, we also have that mindset, which is a good mindset, but we could have saved a lot of problems if we would have just got a, you know, a cylinder piece of steel instead of a big square piece of steel. So getting some matter experts and taking them to lunch, taking them to dinner, getting the information to them and say, hey, look, this is what I want to do. This is the research I've put into it. This is what I'm thinking. Am I way off basis or am I on track? Where should I go? And it's amazing at how fast someone will be like, oh, you need to talk to this person, or they'll give you the information and really get you in contact with people that help you.
I really think the asset conversation also is quite overlooked because there's a lot of hype around side hustles like that. That's a thing, which, I mean, I'm not against that.
Side quests.
But I feel like people are more likely to go out and do, you know, DoorDash or Uber Eats a couple nights a week than they are to buy something that's going to appreciate in value. I don't want to go and start speculating too much about how you would get started today. So I'm just going to talk about the things that we've done that have worked, and how we did get started. I mean, I think understanding wealth building is the first step. Like, you have to understand how wealth is built, because people don't build wealth because they worked harder than everyone else. And that's a common misconception. People think that if you work hard or work harder than others or smarter than others, that you'll do better. And it's really not that. It's really what I said at the beginning, which is the accumulation of assets. And understanding that is the key to starting to build wealth. So I think you and I both purchased a house early on, so that's obviously one of the big assets. But I actually think that assets are not your house. Your house might have some value to it. You might have some equity in it. It might show up on your assets column on your wealth analysis. But your house costs you so much money. It's not producing income. It's not an income producing asset. Let's put it that way. It may appreciate in value. It may turn out to be good for you in the long haul, but it is going to cost you a lot of money to keep it, you know. If somebody wanted to sell me a second house to live in, I wouldn't buy it right now, because it might appreciate in value, but I have to pay for that in the short term. It's not going to make me any money.
Yeah.
Unless I Airbnb it or something.
It's not going to make you comfortable either, because you can only live in one house at a time.
True. So I think the first time that I bought an asset that didn't cost me money to keep it, I was actually probably 19 years old, and actually, let's go back a little further, because when I was working in restaurants and bussing tables as a teenager, like probably 16 years old, an older gentleman came up to me, or he was sitting at his table, and he gestured to get me to come over to the table, and I was like, yeah, is there something I can get for you? And he's like, he hands me this little chunk of metal. I don't think I've ever told you this story, but he hands me this little chunk of metal, and I'm like, what is this? He's like, this is a 1 ounce silver bar, basically. And I'm looking at it like, yeah, what's this about? And he goes and tells me this whole story about how his whole life, every month, he bought as much silver as he could afford. And then in 2008, when everything fell apart, he cashed it all in, and silver was selling for like $50 an ounce. And he was a millionaire overnight, basically, you know. But I started to think about that. I'm like, wow, that's really wild. And then I started studying money and understanding assets versus cash and its decreasing value over time because of inflation. And so the first thing I think I really bought was silver, because I had heard about that from him, and it sparked interest in me. And actually had a buddy that we would go around to the banks and try to find old silver coins at the banks. And we found a lot, actually. We would go and get like $100 and half dollars and sort through them and find the silver ones. So we collected that. But that was one of the first things I bought that didn't go down in value and didn't cost me money to own it. And I don't necessarily recommend people start there, because there's better ways to get started. But I think that is just interesting, and I think you should start understanding why silver would be something that would keep its value and cash wouldn't be. If you don't understand that, you got to start there.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So
that's an interesting one. I've heard you talk about precious metals several times. And I hardly ever keep up with precious metals, because it's so easy to get swept into whatever's the fancy stock is of the month or the week.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Yeah, I watched a YouTube series a long time ago called The Hidden Secrets of Money. And it really explains how our modern financial system works and how inflation works and why precious metals will hold their value. And so I always thought that was always of interest to me, even before I really started building wealth. I was always interested in it. Because a guy coming up to you and telling you some crazy story like that in the middle of lunch rush is just like, you kind of get done with work and you're like, what happened?
Yeah, I have a feeling that I'm going to beat that old guy one day. Come here, son. Let me tell you something.
I mean, I don't believe we're living in a simulation, but I get where people get that feeling sometimes because like something like that happens and you're like, oh, you know, that wasn't normal.
This yeah.
day actually stands out to me a little bit.
Yeah, that's funny. It's funny because like, this is the first year I've ever done this. I bought vintage guitars.
Yeah.
And like, anyone who's ever looked into vintage guitars, they're not cheap. But it's one of those things that like it's appreciating, but it has a little bit more of a value than just its appreciation. Does it give you joy? Do you get to use it? Is it something that's applicable to your life? And that's something that I found as part of an asset too. That's if it's something that's usable and it's not draining. Like, it's not just immediately like a car where you buy a brand new car and when you pull off the parking lot, it immediately drops whatever the 4 million percent that they tell you that it drops. I don't know what that percentage is.
I mean,
but
I would put that on the side of balance where, like, you might buy some things that are technically assets that are technically going to appreciate that aren't really making you a great return on your money.
But they're not
worth
losing.
Having because they bring you joy. And I mean, somebody could also do that with a car that does depreciate. You know, I know there's guys that have cars that have appreciated, especially classic cars. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I digress. We're getting a little bit off topic with that stuff.
No, we never get off topic.
So, just because I think you and I come at this from a little bit of a different perspective. How do you look at income from an asset versus income from a job or earned income?
Income from an asset, okay. Income from an asset is more of, it's a long-term mindset to where I'm willing to be disciplined for a while. Like, I can look in my 401k now and see the amount of money that's in there and be like, oh, that's a lot of money. I want it now. Or I can wait for it to appreciate to its full extent, and it's way more. So it's teaching you, like, it really teaches me a discipline thing to where I have to see that over time it's going to grow even more. To where, what was the other one? Just like a
earned income
to me is immediate satisfaction. I did this thing, I get dollars today. I do this thing, I get dollars today. Earned income is that immediate gratification, but it's also not as large as what I would see appreciation on an asset. To where, like, hey, I only see like 3% growth on this thing. I think the number me and you were talking about earlier was 4-6% on some of the assets we were discussing. That doesn't seem like a lot, and it really isn't year over year, but year over year, when it's 10 to 20 or 30 years, is a very big, there's a big compound effect in there where your money starts to double over time to where.
Yeah, I think it's every 7 years.
That's on 7.2%, I believe. Every 10 years, you double your money. I don't know. There's a great book written by Darren Hardy called Compound Effect. You should read it. It tells you all about it. But if you do a complete breakdown of that, I think it's really teaching you discipline, and like, you're going to have delayed gratification. It's going to be much greater later, where a lot of time earned income is, you did this job, I get paid now, I put effort in, boom, that's earned income. And even like quick, like day traders are trying to do the same thing. Like, they're making some people hit big, but it's very small percent, but they're just making enough, but they're constantly having to stick to it, stay on top of it.
Yeah.
And then you have the, like, the long-term stuff, like what you would do in your 401k. That's, you're going to have millions of dollars in 30, 40 years. But right now you have 100 grand. or you have 50 grand or 20 grand, whatever it is, in your 401k, to where 40 years from now, you're going to have way more. So it's really, to me, is a discipline thing.
Yeah, I do want to, you know, I want to kind of talk about a little bit, where do you start if you're just starting today? Let's say you're 25 years old and you're in a trades job, you're following this podcast and you're like getting the good advice, you know. So you're working in a trade. You're making decent money, but your bank account's not really getting any bigger. You're living paycheck to paycheck. You have a, you know, decent running car. How do you get started building wealth? Because long term, that's not gonna.
Well, first of all, take the feet off the car and put wheels on it so it's not running. It's rolling. No, if you're gonna start out, it's kind of funny because I've heard a lot of people like, you bought your first house when you were 21 years old or however I was. And I was like, yeah, why? Is there an age limit to when you can buy a house? I didn't know that. If I knew I could have got one earlier, I probably would have. And I think a lot of people just don't ask people the right questions. So really the best place to start is someone in your life. I can almost guarantee someone in your life, that someone that you've ran into in your just journey of life, there's someone there that's going to be like, hey, talk to this person. They'll get you straight. Or just walk in the bank and say, hey, I want to buy a house. I want to buy an asset.
They'll at least tell you where to start.
They'll tell you where to start. And we're using house just because that's a really, in my opinion, that's one of the easiest assets to buy.
It's probably easier to get started in the stock market because you can start at a much lower price point. But
yeah,
a house is more approachable for most people.
Yeah, and the stock market, the only reason I say house over the stock market is just it's one of those things that you have to go through the process to start it.
Yeah.
And so, like, it kind of teaches you what things you have to put in order. Or, like, the stock market, you can download Robinhood today and start trading on the stock market immediately.
And I think there's some programs out there where they actually, like, round up your purchases on your debit card and put a little bit of money into mutual funds and index funds. Just while you're buying stuff throughout the week. So, I mean, you could get started that way, but I think most people also want to own a home. They also want to live in it. So,
well, it's one of those joy things.
And it's one of those hard to get things. And,
yeah.
You know, obviously that's somewhere that I think everybody who's wanting to be smarter and wealthier wants to get to that point.
Yeah. And I really like that every time I've talked to multiple different banks, they put you through the process. So it really educates you on, okay, this is how I should be looking at things. And, like, there's no dumb questions. I ask a lot of what I would assume dumb questions still to this day to the banks.
I'd be curious, just for as an exercise, let's pretend you've been renting, you know, this whole time. You're what, 33?
Yep.
So you've finally decided you want to buy a house, or you want to start working towards it. You work in the trades, you know, you make good money. Where would you start, and what would be the things that you would be thinking about differently now?
Things I would look at differently now would be, okay, first of all, I want to know what, if I'm buying a house and we're going to the bank, I would first of all find out, okay, what neighborhood do I want to be looking in, and then I would be looking on realtor.com, Zillow.com, what the average house is in that area that I want to live in, roughly. Okay, I know what the average price that I need to be able to afford. What does that payment look like? There's tons of apps. I would download loan calculators and all kinds of stuff to see what I can afford to put down versus what it is, how much I can do it. Can I afford that monthly payment? Do I have this amount saved? And then after I'm like, okay, roughly that's what's going on, usually I reach out to a realtor. I know some people are against realtors, some people are not. I like to reach out to a realtor and just say, hey, what is the next steps that I would have to do? And they usually go, they'll tell you what to do, which is usually go get pre-approved from a bank. Can you even get that amount of money? Okay, and then that's our limit on what we're going to look for houses. And we're going to start looking at these things. And then the bank also will go through the whole, I need this information from you. I need this, this, this. And they start going through your list of things necessary. And then at least now I have a limit. But I've done a little bit of pre-research before I even started. getting into somebody.
You could probably also just go to whatever learning language model you use and ask, you know, how do I buy a house? You can even give it specific information about your particular situation, and it'll give you good advice. What I was going to say is not so much about how to do it, like the nuts and bolts of buying a house, but more of how to approach it for the first time. If you're in the trades, you can fix stuff, right? Hopefully.
Or you're not in the trades anymore.
I would set my expectations a little bit lower for my first house. And I did. I definitely did that with my wife.
That's very true.
She was on board with that. It's like if it's your first house and you're buying in 2025 or later and you're, you know, looking at interest rates and inflated home values, my thought process would be I want to find a house that I can add value to over the time that I live there. It needs to be livable, but it doesn't have to be stylish. It doesn't have to have a new AC and a new water heater, because I'm going to do that stuff myself. You know, I'm going to put some money into this over time. And then, you know, we've interviewed tons of people that have come in and told us that, because that's what a lot of smart people in trades do, is they get a house that needs some work. They're not exactly happy with it, but they know they should buy a house, and so they buy what they can afford. And that would absolutely be my advice, because even though people are like, oh, I want to wait until interest rates come down, I want to wait until the house prices go down, what if they don't?
You can refinance too.
Yeah. Somebody asked me the other day, they were like, because I was telling them about a real estate deal I was doing, and they're like, you're going to pay over 7% interest. They're like, what happens if the interest rates go down? I'm like, well, if it's worth it, if it's low enough, I'll refinance. But also, I base my income around being able to afford this payment. You know, all my calculations on whether or not this property is a good deal are based on the interest rate I'm able to get today. So even if I don't refinance, I can still continue to own the asset. And that's
still pay for it.
That's the goal. You know, because I really liked what you said earlier about, you know, looking at income from an asset as long-term income. Because really, if you're going to buy a house, hopefully you're looking to live there for, you know, at least 3 to 5 years.
Yeah. You know? And what was you told me the average, I think earlier, was like 4 years or 2 to 4 years, or that's what you should be looking at.
Yeah. Two to four years is a good, you know, time span to look at for getting the most equity and tax.
I gotcha.
Like the tax efficiency. That was a tax conversation,
actually. Yeah.
Because when you sell that house and it's increased in value and you go to buy a new house because it was your primary residence, it's not capital gains tax, it's not income tax.
Well, now we're getting the tax code. We'll have to get some of our buddies in here.
On that at some point and get some people that actually know what they're talking about. But my thought is this. If you buy a house that you can afford on a 30-year fixed mortgage, who cares if the housing market goes down and the house goes down in value for a few years? I mean, you might panic in that moment, but as long as you are able to stay gainfully employed, which is highly likely if you're in the trades, as long as you're still able to make that payment, it doesn't change the fact that you own a house, because your 30-year mortgage isn't going to change.
Yeah, and don't sell. Stick with it.
Don't sell it. Yeah, don't sell it if the market's down. I mean, you do have to be smart about buying a house. I'm not saying that people should go out and just buy the most expensive house they can possibly afford just because they can currently make the payment. Be smart about it, for sure. But if the house did, by some wild chance, go down in value, own it long enough that it can't. Own it long enough that it goes up in value.
Also, own it long enough, and if you're living there that long and you're done paying for it, add on to it. You're a tradesman.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding.
I mean, there you go.
You can build on anything. I forgot about that part. I remember our first house. We weren't even planning on remodeling it when we bought it, but we were in it, and we're like, wait a second. I can add can lights. I can redo the kitchen. We can put a new air conditioner in it. We can do this. How are we going to pay for that? Oh, no, I'll do all of it. I forgot about that part.
Now, you had a couple other questions you wanted to ask. I know we're getting close to time here.
Let me Sorry, I put them closed. We kind of went over the other question. I was, if a paycheck isn't enough, where does real wealth come from?
Yeah.
I mean, you kind of went over that earlier. And you talked about the first asset you ever bought, which was my other question. You talked about the silver. That's a pretty cool story. There is one question. What's the biggest financial lie people believe about money?
Yeah. Let me think about that for just
a second. I'm going to give my 2 cents on this one, just because that's a question that, and it kind of goes along with what I said really early on in today's podcast, which was, I remember thinking, man, if I made $10,000 more a year, I wouldn't have financial problems.
Hmm.
Instead of looking at, if I spend less money, I won't have financial problems. And it really came down to me being disciplined with, oh no, this is how much I make. This, I have to spend X percentage less or X dollars less. And then living by that, no matter what my rate, however much I got paid. And as soon as I figured out how to do that, I was able to start going, I can afford a house. I can afford these other things that do appreciate over time. And I think that that's the lie. If I make more money, I won't have any money problems.
Yeah, I think that is a really good point, because and I was debating about going that direction with it, but I think you've kind of made it an easier choice for me. I think, if you aren't good with money when you have little money, you're not going to be good with money when you have a lot of money, or if you start making more.
Yeah, be faithful over a few things to be faithful for over a lot of things.
Yeah, if you think that money is going to solve all of your financial problems, and then you get more money, you're just going to spend more money. But if you can figure out how to save money when you don't have a lot of money, I mean, there was a time, and this is going to sound crazy because every time I tell people this, they think that I'm making it up. But there was a point when my wife and I were first married. Now, this would have been
last week. I'm just kidding.
This would have been in 2015, sometime in 2015. So 10 years ago. So different financial climate. I mean, groceries were cheaper.
Eggs were cheap.
We lived off of $40 a week for food. I wanted to say $40 for 2 weeks, but I think it was $40 a week for food for the two of us.
That's a lot of chicken McNuggets.
We didn't eat out at all. We invented some new foods, mac and cheese, grilled cheese sandwiches. That was a common something that we ate. Low protein, high carb diet.
Nice. Lots of yellow five. RFK would be very sad.
So, I mean, you can definitely live efficiently, but I don't necessarily recommend going that far. But definitely being, even today, the when I look at even Ramsey's estimates for what a family my size should spend on food, like we are always beating that, because my wife and I are just disciplined about it and diligent about it. And I think most people don't think that way, and you do have to become disciplined. You should become obsessed with budgeting. If you're not making enough money to set aside money now, you need to become obsessed with budgeting until you can. You are going to have to hustle to get there, especially today. But I was going to say, this is the one people talk about a lot. And I don't think most people believe this lie. I think most people know that it's not true. But I do want to say a couple more things about it. It's money will make you happy. I think that most people know that's not true. Like, just inherently, or they've heard people say it won't make you happy. But the thing that I like to tell people about money is, if you're unhappy when you have no money, you'll be unhappy when you have money. And if you are happy when you have no money, you can be happy when you have money. It's a conscious choice about the way that you live your life, to be happy and to enjoy the things that aren't just made for money.
That's true. There's a comedian that always get a kick out of that. line. Money doesn't buy happiness.
Yeah.
But I've never seen anyone on a jet ski that's sad. And money bought that jet ski. But that's it's funny because that is a very true statement. If you're optimistic,
yeah,
you're going to be optimistic no matter what your financial well-being is. But it is funny. I've never seen a lot of sad people do well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think sad and happy makes it a little ambiguous. I think the better word, like you said, is optimism. I mean, if you talk to somebody who is negative, they are not going to be somebody that goes out and invests in real estate or invests in the stock market. Because I'll talk to people and I'll tell people stuff that I'm doing and they'll get up in arms a little bit. I get this reaction all the time. It's like, well, what happens if the stock market crashes? Or what happens if interest rates go down? Or what happens if interest rates go up?
Well, you buy more if it's down.
Well, they're talking about...
Yeah, I know what you mean.
...locked in. But if you're negative, you're not going to choose to do stuff because you're negative. You're going to assume it can't be done. If you're optimistic... And I heard this the other day. You'll like this one. This is a good thing, and I think it's true. You will never see financial leaders... or leaders in general, people that are widely successful, react to leading indicators of trouble. Leaders, and this isn't always a good thing, but leaders and widely successful people are less likely to, you know, run to safety at the first sign of danger. So the first time that, you know, a market report comes out about housing, the people that are optimistic, the people that are, in order to be an entrepreneur, you have to be optimistic. In order to be a successful investor, you have to be optimistic. And optimistic people don't freak out over a small amount of information that something bad's going to happen. It doesn't always work out well for them, but you need that optimism to drive you. And even when it doesn't go well, the people that are optimistic got back on the horse and started working again. In 2008.
Yeah, and they're searching high and low for every possibility to make it work.
Yeah.
They're not stopping because this person said it's bad.
I mean, I've heard of people who lost houses and things went really poorly in 2008 for them. And they turned it around, you know, mm-hmm. because you have to have and when we say optimism, and I think we may have defined this on the podcast before, but when we say optimism, we mean a strong, unrelenting belief that it can be done. Not that every day is awesome. It's not the Lego movie. It's, you know, it's a strong, unrelenting belief that it can be done.
Yeah.
That's what optimism is. And I've met the other sort. I've met the people that every day is awesome, and they have to see it that way.
And it makes you not want to
fizzle out.
Yeah, it makes you not want to be around them either. Like, man, I don't want to be around people that are like, man, we can get things done.
They talked about that in Good to Great a little bit. There's a book by Jim Collins, for those of you that don't know, called Good to Great. And he talks about a prisoner of war. I forget the exact timeline. And I forget the gentleman's name. I think it was Stockton or something. I'm blanking on the name. But he talked about the people that gave up were the optimists because they'd always be saying, you know, we'll be out by Christmas or we'll be out by Easter. And then soon it's Christmas again and they're saying the same thing. And that gets tiresome. If you're always saying, well, it'll be done by this time and it's going to go this well and we're going to make this much money, you're going to be wrong at some point and that's going to drag you down. But if you're optimistic, then when things go wrong, you're saying, this just wasn't the way. You know, this was just one more way that I found not to do this.
The Thomas Edison quote.
Yeah, absolutely.
Found a bazillion ways to not build a light bulb.
Yeah, but it didn't mean that you couldn't light homes with electricity.
Yeah, that didn't mean that he stopped trying to build a light bulb.
Yeah. I mean, our generation thinks he stole the idea, so, you know, whatever.
Oh, I don't know. I'm not on any social media, so I'm never up to date on what's going on. That's funny.
You gotta go listen to the conspiracy podcast to get the real information on the light bulb.
Nice.
But anyway, that's about as much time as we have today. This is a really in-depth subject, and I feel like we did not get as far as I thought we would. So we will definitely have to revisit this. But wealth building, getting started, the key takeaways for you coming out of this, if you've made it this far, thank you. It's, you know, it's a very overwhelming topic if when you're first getting into it. But the key takeaways: look into getting assets. Try to purchase assets before purchasing liabilities, and live below your means. You have to be able to do those two things, because as your means grow, if you're not living below them, you're always going to be ahead of your means. Even if you make astronomical money, you'll find a way to spend it. So figure out how to live below your means, and we'll be back next time to talk more in depth about investing and what other avenues there are for investing. And we're also going to talk to the people that already own a home, what you can do next, because I think a lot of people think once I own a home, then I'm good, right? And there's definitely more to be done.
Stay disciplined.
Yes, stay disciplined. So we will be back next week, and we appreciate you listening.